Facts, recorded by Anthony Borgia. Preface. The spirit communicator of this book has, in previous volumes, dealt solely with descriptions of the spirit world and life in spirit lands generally, and he has hitherto touched only incidentally upon matters concerning faith and morals. In the present work, he abandons descriptions of spirit life, and instead shows the attitude of the spirit world towards certain theological beliefs with reference to a number of texts from the New Testament. A common experience which so many of us undergo when we pass to the spirit world is that of the necessity of readjusting, in varying degrees, our views upon many things in the light of newly gained knowledge and altered position. Our very mode of living undergoes a drastic change. If the laity find this need for the readjustment of views after death, how much more so must it be the case in one who was a priest of the Church, and who on earth was compelled, at least outwardly, to regard all communications from the spirit world as dealings with the devil. My friendship with the communicator of this book, who was a distinguished priest in earth life, began in 1909, 5 years before he went to the spirit world, in circumstances of so pleasant a nature that we are both unlikely ever to forget them. His passing has not meant the severance of that friendship, but its intensification, and that has been accomplished in the one way possible by direct communication with him. In fact, since he took up his residence in the spirit world, I have had many more opportunities of meeting him, together with a goodly company of mutual friends, than would ever have been possible had he remained on earth. It has been my happy experience to act as amanuensis throughout the previous scripts, and in this latest instance to record some of the details of his revised theology. Anthony Borgia. For introductory, in speaking to my friends on earth once again, there is one preliminary observation that I would like to make. It is this: the spirit world is a vast place, and the activities of its inhabitants are upon a gigantic scale. That part of the spirit world in which it is my great good fortune to live represents but an infinitesimal part of the whole. But to attempt to describe every feature of that part any one time and within the covers of a single volume could be impossible. The problem is a common one that confronts every person who wishes to return to Earth, when the opportunity presents itself, to recount his experience as the spirit world. When the theme has been chosen, what shall be set down, what shall be omitted? Such being the case, some of my good friends on earth are bound, in some measure, to be disappointed, because they have not dealt fully enough with some point which has aroused their interest. That I very much regret, and I hope that these few preliminary words will help to make the position clear. In the matter of the theme of these writings, I have not, at any time, relied upon my own judgment. But I have been fortunate in always having at my side wise and gifted counselors, whose experiences of life in the spirit world and of the varying conditions of communication with the earth world are wide. These friends are constantly giving me the benefit of their sterling advice upon all matters relative to these writings, and I have in all cases followed their advice. Hitherto we have confined our descriptions and discussions to the spirit world and the life which some of us, its inhabitants, live in these beautiful realms. Some people on earth profess to take little interest in the kind of life which is led by a great community of us in spirit lands. They prefer something a little less material, a little more elevated descriptions of delightful houses and gardens, of beautiful landscapes, of pleasant occupations and enjoyable recreations. They feel that such things do not accord with what should be their ultimate destiny in the life hereafter. But I would ask such folk to devote a few quiet moments to the subject, and to ask themselves just what they feel the life hereafter really ought to be, if they had the ordering of such things. Wherein would they find their happiness? Of what nature would they wish their surroundings to be? One cannot imagine such folk being contented to spend eons of time in the spirit world occupied in some form of spirit contemplation to find the exclusion of all other forms of activity, if contemplation can, in this sense, be considered an activity at all. My experience has been that people who call the loudest for a highly spiritualized form of life in the world are the first, when they come here to the spirit world, to be profoundly glad to see about them the many examples of material beauty and grandeur taking an outward form that they can quickly and easily recognize and understand. Indeed, the multiplicity of delights that are to be encountered has the effect of speedily and effectively driving out of their heads any ideas of spending valuable time in contemplation, except to contemplate upon their great good fortune in finding things as they are, and not as they might have been inclined to advocate when they were incarnate. So many things are nicer in the abstract than in the concrete. A lifetime spent in contemplation might be one of them. I have been advised that the time would be appropriate for me to leave for the present, at least, any further account of our life in these realms and, instead, to treat matters of equal importance concerning our two worlds, yours and mine. But before doing so, there are one or two considerations which I should like to place before you, since they have a direct bearing upon our principal theme. You must know, then, that the spirit world has been in existence for countless millions of years of earthly time. The earth world is but a toddling infant by comparison with the seemingly incalculable age of the spirit world. Together with the age of the spirit world are the laws that govern it. These laws have remained constant, unvarying, invariable, and in absolute continuity of existence and operation throughout this colossal period of time. The spirit world, with great hosts of its inhabitants, has seen the dawn of the earth world, and those same great hosts have watched, too, the formation of the spirit spheres that are situated, as I have elsewhere explained to you, in concentric circles around the earth. It is not my purpose to discuss the formation of the spirit spheres, since it has no direct reference to our present subject. Beings in the exalted realms have beheld the evolution man on earth, and they have assisted in that evolution. They have watched man's steady spiritual and material progression. Man, as he now is, was not created upon the instant, as the Church teaches, in the image and likeness of his Creator. He was slowly and steadily evolved from a lower order of creatures. The image and likeness were to come later. The Paradise of Eden is the best attempt at an explanation of the creation of man six that man himself could that time evoke. The story of the first man and woman, whom the earth world has come to name Adam and Eve, is natural corollary to the legend of their creation. Had the story ended with this supposed couple enjoying to the end of their earthly days the pleasures and delights their ideal abode, the earth world would have been saved immensity of pain and suffering, of persecution, wars, and bloodshed, and a score of other tribulations and calamities. But some explanation was bound to be given as why this earthly paradise was not still flourishing, and so there was invented the utterly nonsensical and completely false doctrine of the fall of man, and that from this fall the whole of mankind is forever tainted with original sin. The various churches of the earth plane are by no means of one mind upon what is exactly meant by sin. But the different interpretations of the doctrine have one point in common: they are all equally and completely erroneous. It is the belief of the church to which I belonged when I was on earth that Adam and Eve were immortal in their earthly bodies, that the process known as physical was as yet unknown. These two individuals that were so constituted that they were living, as it were, in two worlds at once. They were, in fact, partly of the spirit world and partly of the earth world. It was the sin of these supposed first parents, the father of the universe, to invent the death physical body. He cast them out of paradise, condemned them to death, and that death became communicable like some pestilent disease to all future generation of mankind. The whole fabrication of the history of the creation of man and his subsequent disaster is a gross insult to the infinite mind. The complexity of church doctrines and creeds that have their origin or basis in the fable of our first parents, a totally inadequate attempt to explain what the early churchmen were completely unable to explain. The Christian civilization of the earth world dates the commencement of its history at about 2,000 years ago of earthly time. 2,000 years, they are but a grain of sand, one single grain of sand, in a whole vast desert of time. What was happening on earth before those 2,000 years commenced? The earth, you are taught to believe, was mostly in a state of paganism, where the people worshipped a multiplicity of gods, and changed their gods as their fancy led them. The Great Father had, in fact, more or less abandoned his earthly children for countless millions of years, and he only, at last, bethought him to send salvation to earth 2,000 years ago, after eons and eons of seven time had passed by in neglect. Such, in effect, is what you are asked to believe, as we, of the spirit world, see it. The devil, of course, appears in this story of the first man and woman. It is he who caused their downfall. One might ask, who is this mysterious devil who, ever since his first great achievement in the Garden of Eden, has spent its time and energies wandering through the world for the ruin of souls? On a former occasion I spoke to you about this seemingly ever-present gentleman. After hearing so much about him when I was incarnate, one of the early questions that I asked concerned the existence or otherwise of Satan. Did such a person really exist? I was told that there was no truth whatever in the story, that somewhere in the lowest realms there was a prince of evil whose sole object was to place himself in direct opposition to the Father of all good, and whose function was to lure souls into the commission of base deeds that would encompass their eternal damnation. That, I was assured, was all sheer nonsense. If one were to traverse the dark realms and make a really comprehensive survey of those regions, one might, after careful elimination, find one or more souls who were considerably lower in the scale of evil than their fellows. Conceivably, one might even find one who was so debased that those in evil light feel inclined to regard him as something of a leader in evil ways. That there is one who is indisputably the prince of evil, no, he simply does not exist. Every inch of the dark realms has been surveyed by beings of the highest realms, and they have so far failed to discover this personage. Not that they set out for that purpose. The knowledge that all such high beings possess tells them that there is no such person as the devil. But in the sense that all evil people in the realms of darkness can be called devils, then there are many devils. The devil is supposed to take upon him many disguises. In the story of the Garden of Eden he became serpent. At the present day upon earth, the Church claims that the devil manifests himself by masquerading as an angel of light in the seance chamber, where he carries on his fell work of luring souls to their doom. In such cases, then, the devil has even, on occasion, claimed to have been a former priest of the Church. We can afford to smile at such stupidity. But we are also saddened by it. Living in the spirit world, as all the beauties and marvels, all the joys and delights, and the heaven-sent opportunities of doing good and useful work ever around us, we can see the profound darkness of so much of what we call religious thought when we live on the earth plane. We can recall how strenuously we upheld some doctrine or another as being vitally important to the soul's salvation, only to find, when we came to live for all time in the spirit world, that such doctrine counts for nothing, literally nothing. It shows itself for what it is, completely meaningless. It becomes disintegrated by the great truths that are before us here. Such, for example, is soon to be discovered in the story of our supposed first parents and the story of original sin. It is as impossible to find Adam and Eve, or their equivalent, in the spirit world, as it is impossible to find the devil, and for the same reason. They simply do not exist. It might be possible to ascertain who were among the first of the earth world's inhabitants to show the first signs of dawning intelligence, but who would be the better for the discovery? The whole great organization of the earth world has been a slow process of evolution and progression. Man did not suddenly come into being at the word of the Father of the universe, as it were, overnight. The whole procedure has occupied thousands of years of earthly time, and it is still going on, despite appearances to the contrary. The earth world and its inhabitants, whether man or beast, are corruptible. But the etheric counterpart of the earth world, for such we might roughly designate the spirit spheres that are concentric with it and the spiritual element of both man and beast, all these are incorruptible. Primitive man upon earth plane was subject to the very same natural laws as are you at this moment of time. From the instant of its beginning, the earth world has been subject to the laws of corruption. Primitive man died, undergoing therein a process exactly similar to that which I underwent, though the circumstances of it might be widely different. That same primitive man is now resident in the spirit world. His features have changed throughout the countless years, until he has grown like ourselves in general conformation. He has progressed by virtue of his birthright, the same birthright that we all possess, you, who are incarnate, and I, who am discarnate, together with all the innumerable millions of souls in both worlds. And that birthright is the full and free title to, and the ability and opportunity for, limitless progression. Who is to say how far progression can be extended in each individual? To us here it seems limitless. Primitive man, as the very early inhabitants of earth are called, is here with us in the spirit world. Such souls are the occupants of the highest spheres. They came here, as they left the earth world you would regard them, as savages. Their features would perhaps suggest that ability to unite to the dwellers of the spirit world of those far-off times they were human souls, rough cast, maybe, lacking in knowledge of spiritual things such as you enjoy today, but nevertheless possessed of some glimmerings of spiritual light. With their advent into the spirit world, they were soon taken in hand by wondrous souls who had never had an incarnate existence, but who belonged to the world of spirit, and to the world of spirit alone. Under such magnificent instruction and guidance, these primitive souls progressed out of all recognition of their former selves. At this moment of time you would be unable to identify a being who was once called primitive man, now differentiate him from any other inhabitant from his own high realm. While primitive man was being carefully evolved into a higher being in the spirit world, his brother still upon earth was undergoing a similar transformation, until he bore all the characteristics which are familiar to mankind at this present moment. The spiritual and material evolution of man upon the earth plane is still going on, and it will ever so continue. What is to be the great end is not for me to hazard a guess. Such things are the closely guarded secrets of the highest spheres, and it is problematical whether we should be the better off if we were to be fully informed upon the matter. Religiously speaking, man has divided his existence so far into two epochs, Christian and pre-Christian. In the latter epoch, you are told, the world was spiritually dark. Mankind was still laboring, as best he could, under the supposed wrath of God, for the commission of the great sin of our first parents. According to the ancient books and chronicles, a deliverer would be sent, but of the time and place and circumstances of his coming no man knew. At length, at a period which is reckoned at about 2,000 years ago, a great being was born upon earth. By some he was hailed as the long-awaited deliverer, by others this was rigorously denied. After nearly 2,000 years have passed, there still remains the same divided thought as to whether God sent his deliverer. The birth upon the earth plane of that illustrious soul so many years ago was eventually to stir men's minds, as they had not been stirred before. Manuscripts were supposedly containing the many acts and words performed and spoken during his short life on earth, together with his teachings. From this, there has been built up a vast theology, so abstruse, so complex, so incomprehensible that no man can explain it, and so controversial that scores of distinct and separate ten and opposed religious sects have arisen upon the earth plane, each claiming to be more or less the only true means of the soul's salvation. As a priest of one of the principal of these religious denominations, I upheld, when I was upon earth, all its doctrines and creeds. When I eventually came to live in the spirit world, I found that the whole of my theological knowledge was completely negative or stultified by my first sight of the truths of the spirit world, of its people, and of its laws. I found that as far as the people of earth were concerned, they had never lived for one single fraction of the moment under the wrath of God, for the all-sufficing reason that the great Father of Heaven cannot entertain wrath against any person or persons whatsoever for any reason or reasons whatsoever. How do I know this, it may be asked? The answer is simple, it is common knowledge in the spirit world. We, in these realms, all know it. Therein lies the immeasurable beauty of it. It is apparent at every turn. The wrath of God is a stupid and wicked fiction. Numberless false theories have been propounded from it, and numberless false doctrines have been formulated. The most elementary acquaintance with the laws of the spirit world will at once show that the wrath of God is a contradiction of terms. The two words cannot exist together. That is also common knowledge in these realms, elementary knowledge. The wrath of God, indeed. But that is not all. Jesus, the great teacher who was born upon earth 2,000 years ago, was cast out of the earth world violently and shamefully by the people of earth. This tragic transition was an act of expiation to the Eternal Father for the wrath he felt, and as a means of saving the earth world's inhabitants. So it is still taught in the churches of earth. The blood sacrifice of his only son. Such beliefs as these are primitive and barbaric, and monstrous when viewed in the light of the great truths of the spirit world, as we know and understand them here. Since the first moment when the earth world existed, exalted beings of the highest realms have had it in their charge. As you contemplate the chaotic condition prevailing at the present time, you may be disposed to think that these same beings have dismally failed in their task. That is not so. They have not failed. When man was first evolved from a lower order of creatures, he was constantly watched and aided. As primitive man grew in intelligence, he was in active communication with the spirit world by the operations of those higher 11 senses which are inherent in every soul, but which lie fallow and undeveloped chiefly through man's ignorance. The progression of the earth world and its inhabitants has been slow, steady, and uninterrupted thousands upon thousands of years of its life. Never for one instant of time were the two worlds out of direct contact. All this while, man was and still is exercising his free will. Sometimes he listened to the voices from the spirit world, then all was well. Many times his ears were deaf to those voices, then all was ill. The guidance was ever there. The road of salvation was always the same. To teach that one great soul should suffer all the torments of persecution and a horrible death in order to save the world from damnation, and to teach same that this same tragedy should be demanded by the Father of Heaven to appease his wrath, is not only revolting in itself to us here in the spirit world, but it is far, far worse. He is the grossest libel, the greatest defamation, to put it at its very least, that could ever be contemplated. Upon the character and nature and the very essence of the great Father of the universe, we who live in the spirit world can see the might and majesty of the Father's great creation, the universe. But we can also see what is far greater and far more majestic. Man himself. It will be said, perhaps, that there cannot be anything very mighty and majestic about those hideous denizens of the dark realms I have described. No. In their present state, most certainly not. But resident within every one of those unfortunate beings, there is the germ of spiritual evolution and progression. And therein lies his might and majesty. Remember those primitive men who have so evolved and spiritually progressed that they are now dwellers in the highest realms, who are possessed of immense knowledge and wisdom, and who are, in every sense, wondrous souls. Throughout the whole course of the earth world's existence, there have been born into it great teachers of great truths. There has been a long succession of them in the past. And they will so continue to come in the future. It rests with man himself, whether he heeds such teachers or rejects them. Entrance to the spirit world is gained in one way only, through the death of the physical body. No person or persons can assign to a single soul any other place in the spirit world than that which that soul has merited for himself. He cannot be saved through the intermediation of another, whoever that other may be. His merits for a realm of beauty, as his residence, must be his own merits. No other person can share his burden if his life upon earth has been hideous. He pays the penalty himself, as I have already tried to indicate to you. 12. If this be the case, and it is, of what use is the constant repetition of elaborate creeds and the perpetual reiteration from dismal and protracted formularies, in both of which the spiritual life of incarnate man is hemmed in and suffocated? There is no magic formula upon the pronouncing of which a safe journey to the spirit world is assured and a salubrious destination procured. Our merits alone will provide those, and no one can plead for us before the great throne. Our life upon earth is our sole advocate and our most eloquent for the state of our being when we arrive in the world of spirit. And that same life is also our incorruptible judge. The many orthodox religions that have sprung up during the course of the 2,000 years past are all of them completely out of touch with the realities of the spirit world. They are all of them based upon entirely false values and conceptions. Some religious bodies are presumptuous enough to profess to know exactly what is in the Heavenly Father's mind. Others lay stress upon the saving power of Jesus, that great soul whom the earth rejected 2 millenniums ago. They claim that none can be saved, except they be saved through him. By constantly reiterating this in the many rather fulsome and frigid prayers that are said publicly, it seems to be believed that some magical process will be put into operation whereby the soul can be assured that, wherever else it may go, when death takes place it will not go for all eternity to hell. Indeed, it may be said that orthodoxy bases its only hope of the soul's salvation upon the merits of another. It is in this respect that orthodoxy has taken the spin and made of it a Christian spirit world, or, at least the religious teachers would say that the Christian element more than predominates. As an inhabitant of the spirit world, I soon discovered that the spirit world is so much greater than what the earth world enunciates the Christian religion. Indeed, it is a way beyond all earthly religions of whatever denomination. It is made up of peoples from every quarter of the earth world, representing every school of earthly religious thought. In the realms wherein I dwell, we have cast aside forever the allegiance to the church of our earthly lives. We have no orthodox religion here. We are all of one mind, and that mind is regulated by the strict truth. I have already recounted to you how in certain quarters of these realms one can find churches, such as are to be found upon the earth plane, supported by adherents of a variety of religious sects. But that makes no difference whatever to my statement that we have done with earthly religions. These churches are 13 permitted to exist under conditions that are perfectly understood, and as perfectly defined. They merely form a carefully segregated community that is bound by strict rules. There is no harm in erecting a beautiful edifice in the style and manner of earthly ecclesiastical buildings. It is what takes place within them that is subject to the most exact laws. The spirit world, in short, is undenominational. Orthodoxy may make as many claims as it wishes in respect of its self-arrogated right to be the guardian of man's immortal soul. Admittance to the spirit world is not through any one church or collection of churches, nor is it obtained through the merits of any one person or body of persons. There is no saint of the ecclesiastical calendar whose merits will assist us to escape or dodge the results of our wrongdoing when we were incarnate. We must pay ourselves alone. Nor will membership to the church, which makes the greatest claims of assuring salvation for ourselves, avail us one fraction. We undergo the experience of passing through the portal of physical death alone, although we may have willing help in the actual procedure from those who are already discarnate. But it stops there. Such helpers cannot assign us to any destination other than that which we have